What's that?
Welcome back to Afoot, a mystery genre podcast in which we talk about all things, whether there are bloody footprints leading up to a door, a snowy night in which figures are seen in the distance, masked marauders, whatever, or sometimes just a little comfortable country house in which something goes terribly wrong and no one's actually hurt. Joining me, Glenn Fleischman, your host, is several panelists from our regular pool of Afoot panelists, and tonight we have to talk about the Veronica Mars TV series, Season 1. We'll be firing off a spoiler horn later, but for now, we're going to talk more generally, and joining me is Jenny Leader. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
Erica Ensign. Hello, Erica.
Hello.
James Callan. James, hello.
Hello.
And
bring it on, yeah.
Oh, the music was running through my heads. And Katie Lane. Hello, Katie.
Howdy. James, you totally stole my joke.
Oh, I've
been
practicing
my falsetto for days and days.
Only one.
We can do an a cappella routine at the end.
Only one person in this podcast is actually in Portland. James is Portland adjacent, but only one Portlander this time, as opposed to our usual Portland heavy podcast schedules. Because Portland's where it happens. What was it near the end of the season? It wasn't Boots Are Made for Walking. She was singing, this is not a spoiler, she was singing, I'm gonna get you. I'm gonna find you.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get you.
Oh, yeah. One way or another.
Great. And then it was stuck in my head for like 2 weeks. So
worse fates.
It's kind of catchy theme song. So here's the thing. Veronica Mars, I did not like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I did not watch this in its original run. Everybody said, this is a great series. We should cover it. I said, great. I'm going to commit. I'm going to watch at least several episodes. Jenny, you assembled a list of critical episodes, and I watched the whole season. I watched all of season one because,
and I binged one it. Of us. Yeah. One of us. Right.
I never binge, and I binged. I watched like in like multi-hour chunks over not that many days. I watched the whole thing, so it's great, and I loved it. At the end. Anyway, what do you guys think?
I'm not
experienced, so I think we were talking about doing a kind of a spoiler-free recap for those like me who are still not. Martians, and then we'll go into the spoiler-filled version later. So I see many hands, virtual hands raised in my mind. So what should we talk through? You guys can talk about this so much more expertly than I can because you've all seen the whole run. What's the show about?
It's a tiny, sassy, blonde detective who's also a high school student, and her father is a private eye. He used to be a sheriff, but there was a scandal, and he's not a sheriff anymore.
Wow, that's really good. That was kind of your high school experience, wasn't it?
Oh, exactly.
It's very universal, I think. Jenny, best friend murdered by someone unknown.
Jenny, I can picture you most readily as Veronica Mars. It's true. No offense to anybody else in this podcast, but I kind of say.
I do have the nickname Genesee.
It's true. You have to watch out around Jenny. She knows where everything is. It's kind of scary. But no, I think that's good. I mean, going in, I didn't really know what to expect with it. I knew it was like, it's kind of the girl detective, but much more like sophisticated than that. And, I feel like having watched this first season and planning to watch the rest, I have like this trio of like young female detectives, sort of. So Buffy, Kim Possible, the animated series, and Veronica Mars, they all have a lot in common and they overlap a little bit by year. So Buffy's first, then Kim Possible, then Veronica Mars, but they did run into each other and they're all like, sassy, hip, like funny, but actually girls. Like they're not trying to be, it's not boys' roles written as girls. It's people with, teenage experience into young adulthood and what they're doing. And I kind of like the honesty of that.
Yeah. Although I was reminded when I was skimming the Wikipedia article again tonight that apparently when Rob Thomas was originally writing it, he wrote it as a young adult novel with a male protagonist and then switched it when he did the TV series.
I saw that.
Interesting. Yeah. I saw that.
But I distinctly get the impression it wasn't like he'd written the entire role and then decided at the last minute. It was kind of an earlier in the process switch.
I think the whole show seems to be full of old souls though. Like she's, at some level you could picture her as a 65-year-old guy chomping on a cigar too. Like she's hard bitten.
She's also, she also is a teenager. She looks at the world with a teenager's perspective and she makes mistakes the way that a teenager would, thinking that you have enough information about either how the world works or how people interact that you can totally read a situation. And it's not until you're, you know, 10 paces into it that you realize, oh, no, there's something fundamental that I missed out on. And that's not a hit against teenagers. It's just purely the process of growing up and learning and gathering experience. And that's one of the things I really like about the show is that they let her be that age and have those kinds of experiences instead of trying to dumb down the high school experience or belittle the friendships that happen in high school. It seems very respectful of being a teenager.
Yeah, they do a great job of making her exceptionally smart, but not particularly wise. I mean, she's not totally green, but she's, you know, she's new to the hard-bitten role and clearly, you know, is like you say, as she's of her age, she's a 17-year-old, a 17-year-old Philip Marlowe.
Oh, that is one thing I did notice, again, from watching it again for like, I don't know how many times now, but that everyone at the beginning of every show, like she suspects is always like not the right person. And then she has to like somehow creatively like apologize to that person. And then she finds out who it really is. She gets really good at that. But I like that where it's like your first assumption is not always the right assumption. They like really like point that out in almost every single episode.
That is one of my favorite things about the show, too. I mean, I love a character at the center of a show who is very cool and smart. And she is. She's young. She's super smart. She's super competent. But I like that they let her be fallible because when you have the main character who is always right about everything, it gets a little boring. And there are a couple of instances, which I can talk about after the spoiler horn, where she really is even more on the wrong side of things than she usually is. And, you know, you can watch her growing up. She's being a teenager and she's learning about the world. And sometimes those lessons come hard.
Yeah, they hurt.
I feel like we should mention this thing. Anyone who watches the show will realize this is, and this is part of the show, is she's an exceptionally beautiful woman. I mean, Kristen Bell is ridiculously good looking. But the show doesn't make a deal out of that too much. I feel like there's one episode in which she's dressed up like a Japanese anime character where I was like, this crosses the line a little bit. Like there was no reason for her to do that. Also not a spoiler. But I felt in general, even though she's dressed sort of appropriate to the age, maybe even more appropriately than kids that age would dress. But it's just a thing. She is really gorgeous, but it doesn't become an obsessive point. And she's not treated, I think, by and large, by the camera in an unpleasant way, which is something that I think makes the show more empowering. If she were just an object to be ogled, then as well as, you know, the other parts of the show. This is the thing, we talk about this with on other parts of the Incomparable Network. In Voyager, 7 of 9 is, you know, Jerry Bryan is gorgeous and tall and whatever. And it's like, yeah. But let's talk about the acting because, boy, does she do a good job with that role, you know? And maybe they intended that to be something different, but it came out the way. So I don't know. I mean, it's not like an elephant in the room, but it is a thing. And it's an exceptionally gorgeous cast on the whole. They cast really good looking people because that's what you do in TV, too.
Because, well, of course, it's in California, home of the beautiful people. I mean, so many of her classmates are highly attractive people as well.
Even the plain girls are attractive.
Right.
Oh, yes. They're wearing glasses, though, so.
And their hair is a little bit more frizzy than the other girls.
They have a little red streak in the hair. That indicates that they're edgy. Although there is an episode we'll talk about. There's one episode that has, I think, treats the issue of edgy kids. Oh, my God. Was that perfect? It was perfect. Is it time to fire off the spoiler horn?
Before you do that, I would like to give
Belay
some
that
more.
Horn.
Some more general praise. You mentioned the way that the camera treats Veronica, sort of not as an object. Just that made me think about sort of the way that the whole show is viewed and the choice of how to treat flashbacks and sort of dream-ish sequences, which is something that crops up a lot in this season. And, you know, every show has to make the decision, is it going to be sepia tone? Is it going to be black and white? Are you going to get the, you know, the wiggly lines on the screen all Scooby-Doo style? and I quite like, it's really just sort of differently graded color-wise, and it does have a somewhat dreamlike, ethereal feel, which I think works very well because This is memory being played out, and depending on which person you're seeing, you might be seeing something slightly different from a different point of view, And I'm a big fan of the way that they chose to do it. It doesn't intrude as much as some other shows do.
I really like how they made her seem more young and innocent with the way they styled her too. Definitely tell it's a flashback because like the very beginning, she like comes off as like, she's a little bit hardened from having this like rough situation that happened to her. She's very guarded. She has like shorter hair. And then in all the flashbacks, she's much softer. She has long hair. She's more innocently dressed. She's not as like punky. And you can definitely tell a difference of like just what happened to her has changed her look.
Well, and that's not something you usually get with a hard-nosed detective. You usually get a little bit of backstory about why they're hard-nosed, but you don't always get to see them as they were before.
Right.
And that's really fun about those flashbacks is being able to see that Veronica was still herself, obviously, but she was very different in some important ways. And that I think helps you understand her better in the quote unquote present.
I just realized why I didn't see this show. My older son was born a month before it premiered.
That'll do it.
This all makes
Glenn
sense.
Glenn has just solved his own mystery.
Well, my dad, who's now in his 70s, he loved this show. He raved about it. When I told him we were going to do an episode, he was excited I was going to finally watch it. And I'm like looking at it, I'm like, oh, that's it. Okay. Now I understand. So I'm like, why would this is the kind of thing I would watch. Why didn't I watch it? I like the treatment of flashbacks quite a bit as well. I had that same reaction that they soften her and she seems more relaxed. She's not as hardened. Everything was more innocent back before. So have we said enough? Is it time to raise the veil, lower the veil?
I would like to think that people out there who are listening who have not yet watched Veronica Mars are now motivated to pause this podcast, go out to whatever system you can get it from. I watched it on Amazon Instant Streaming. And join us. Become one with the Veronica, with the marshmallows.
Press pause and we'll see you in about 14 hours.
Yeah, it's right. 22 episodes. You can totally do it.
It's a good weekend binge.
You're done.
You can binge it. It'll happen. And come back. Amazon Prime, as we record this, at least, Amazon Prime has it for free, which is cool. So I watched it on Amazon Prime, which has a nice aspect on my TV set, at least, of coming in blurry before it goes to high res. So the beginning of every episode for me is kind of a wash of abstract colors before it gets into 1080p, and then it's much better.
The app has little like IMDb things in it too, with little trivia things.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Although those, when I started watching season two, I watched the first 20 minutes and those go away. I was a little disappointed. So I kept going, oh, I can't find out if that's Jessica Chastain.
I had that. Well, we'll talk about, I have the Jessica Chastain story sort of, but I'll tell when we get to that point. So I'm going to fire off the spoiler horn. All right, it's time to talk turkey. So we can talk about, I mean, there's 22 episodes. We won't go through all of them, obviously, but the story arc. I mean, does somebody want to, or multiple people want to talk about, like, before we kind of walk through the season, what they expected when you first, turned this thing on? Do you have any anticipation that they'd be able to sustain something like that?
I mean, it's interesting because, like, there's basically three season-long mysteries, two of which are introduced in the first episode, I mean, and it's, you know, the first one obviously is who killed Lily Kane, her best friend who is murdered. And then who raped Veronica at Shelley Pomeroy's party, the mysterious party. Those are both, you know, mentioned in the first episode and not investigated in every single episode. And then later, I can't remember exactly when it first comes up, but the issue of who is her actual father.
I started
suddenly
seeing,
becomes
there was foreshadowing, but like episode three, I was like, there's a paternity thing going on here. And then by episode five, I'm like, oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then all three of those get tied up in the last two episodes of the season. So, and you know, especially the murder, of course, I guess it's probably at least mentioned in every episode. I don't think it's actively, I don't think there's active progress in every episode.
The flashbacks would always like bring, if they were going to talk about it in the episode, the flashbacks, like the recaps before the episode start would kind of like bring it in. So you knew kind of like, oh, they're probably going to talk about this more this episode. I always noticed that.
Even when they weren't directly sort of interrogating that part of things, every once in a while you would get Instead of a flashback, you'd sort of get a dream sequence or something of Veronica pretending that Lily is there and saying, I can't believe you're doing this. Or, you know, if I was here, I would I would help you or hurt you or whatever. So you get reminded of the fact that her murderer is still out there on the loose, even if Veronica is not actively searching for them at that time.
That's right. Oh, because we know early on that. Yeah, because actually the mystery of why there's another one. This is sort of a subplot because it relates to the paternity thing is why Duncan abruptly broke up with Veronica.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
But that's obviously part of that. So, I mean, they
that's just, like the most normal mystery of the like, that's like an actual teen mystery. Why did that guy dump me?
The way in which they sustained a possible incest plot was really, they did it without it getting too creepy, except the characters would squick themselves out, which was actually very realistic, I thought.
Yeah, we were like, Veronica, like, thought about it and then vomited on the side of her car.
Oh my god, that's great.
So it's interesting that they were able to sustain that and like and keep you with the story and keep you interested. It's also interesting because I think Duncan is the most boring character entire cast.
He's like imported from another show.
He is, and it's just so frustrating because like you watch Logan, which I think was not intended. I don't think he was intended to be a central character from the setup of the first couple episodes.
That's what this. Yeah, I don't think he was.
But I think the actor did such a good job that you're like, okay, I want to see you play with this story. I want to see what you can do. Whereas Duncan is just, sorry.
Yeah, I appreciate
that. I'm sure Teddy Dunn is a very nice man.
But he's now a lawyer, which is probably understandable.
Oh, see, lawyers.
I appreciate that Logan, like, you know, they set him up to be, and I think that's part of the evolution as the series went on, season went on, is that they set Logan up to be kind of a jerky jughead, like evil jughead character. Like, I mean, if this is
he's
Riverdale.
He's like the first one she always like assumes is like part of the plot.
Yeah, then he's got all these little sophisticated pieces that come out about him. And he's kind of a jerk and he's wild, but then it's like, oh, you know, he really gave him a heart.
Yeah.
He's troubled.
My favorite part about him was his little, whenever time she'd leave him messages and he'd have like little quotes of the day.
Right. The inspirational little, quote. Like,
the little, each of those little things, it just made me smile a little bit.
It was a nice character touch. I was a little bit nervous going back and watching this again because I hadn't seen it for a while. And I recently went back and rewatched the beginning, I'm not done yet, of Gilmore Girls. And I don't know if you're familiar with that show, but when I originally watched it, I was Team Jess all the way. And now that I'm grown up, I've watched it and was like, he is a horrible little person. What did I see? So I was very afraid that I was going to see Logan as, you know, the bad boy and have completely changed my mind because, you know, when you're young, you like the bad boys sometimes. I sure did. And thank goodness I still enjoyed him. I'm still Team Logan 100%.
I do have to say, I think Logan is they have great chemistry. He's a great romance. It sort of bugs me, and this gets out of season one, but it sort of bugs me that even by the time of the movie, like there's still this, like, they're destined to be together. And I'm like, they met in high school.
Yeah.
He is the perfect guy to be, like, he's a great high school boyfriend.
Totally.
Who has more depths than you think. But really, 10 years on, we're supposed to be like, he was the one? No, I can't. I'm Team Logan up to a point. Although, I also have to admit, I'm kind of, I like her chemistry with Leo a lot, although that was not.
Oh, yeah, I loved Leo.
Yeah, I mean, and it was definitely better than with Duncan.
I can't hear you.
Well, that was in season one.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right.
Leo is the deputy that she hooks up with for like three episodes.
The one dumb deputy that just falls for her like nobody's business and is willing to give her like third, fourth, fifth chances.
I love that guy.
He's a total lummox, but he's great.
I went to a wedding recently where I feel like the groom was actually, he's very much a Leo, like very funny, not like, you know, like very handsome in a particular way, but you have to appreciate that instead of it just being like the, you know, the Logan or Duncan handsome and very, very dry humor, but very smart.
I just thought it was kind of weird, though, that he's so much older than she is. She's not even 18 yet, and her dad's letting her date this 20-year-old guy. Like, that would not have flown in my hometown. I don't know.
He was 21, though, wasn't he?
No, he was 20. And I actually like that there's one episode where they carefully spell out exactly how many months older.
Yeah,
like, that's true. You're 24, you're 26 months older than me. So it was like, so it's like, Yes. Okay. It's on the edge of, it's not exactly creepy because he's not that old, but at the same time, it's not.
The one thing that always boggled my mind was how he got to the dance that one time when she was like, the 80s dance.
Yeah, yeah.
Like all of a sudden he was like there beside her car while she was crying. Like, where did he come from?
There was a line that said that Meg called him. He still would have had to take a lot of time to get into that.
He was in that 80s outfit.
Yes, exactly.
It turns out he's a stalker. He's kind of creepy.
I liked Meg a lot because she was an unexpected character. She felt more real to me because she wasn't I'm blanking on the head cheerleader's name, who was exactly
Madison Sinclair.
Yes, I don't know how I forget that name. I mean, Madison Sinclair is,
which is a total great 18 in the 2000s name, actually.
It's true. But Madison is absolutely stereotypically perfectly, you know, what you'd expect from that. And then Meg is not. Meg is a much more sophisticated character. She gives Veronica chances. They have difficulty in the relationship. And she even gives her some pretty good advice. So should we walk through some episodes a little bit? We're not going to cover everything, but I feel
can I ask you a question? Like, can we jump into the big end of the spoiler pool to start with?
Yeah.
Because I'm curious, because Glenn, you're the one that's seen it most recently, as in, like, you hadn't seen it before. Did you figure out who killed Lily Kane before the reveal?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm trying to remember because I don't think, no, I didn't. I think I think the logic of it was good. I thought they're setting us up to believe that Duncan had done it in sort of, like, what do they call that? It's like
an epileptic rage.
Yeah, but it's like
you know, ableism. Those epileptic rages that everybody talks about.
Well, right. They cited the a very ones. Particular kind of epilepsy. And I'm like, God they researched that, and that's okay. Like, people are blanking out and whatever. But I was like, I thought everything was set up that. So what I saw it happen was everyone believed Duncan did it, and I figured his own parents did too. But I wasn't confident because it was set up so far in advance. I didn't think they'd telegraph it that far, because then what's going to happen at the end of the last episode? Like, yep, oh yeah, he did, and we have some video from the house or whatever, and Abel Kuntz gets released maybe, and the horrible Mr. Weedman, what's his name, the security,
oh yeah, Clarence Weedman,
yeah, Clarence Weedman, gets sent off to jail, which we don't get that resolution as far as I know. Does that happen in season 2? Does anything happen to Clarence Weedman, or he's just gone?
No.
He shows up again, but I will not spoil anything.
Okay, all right. I'm just surprised. I was expecting there's some loose threads there. But no, I never saw the Aaron Eccles thing coming, and it made perfect sense. I mean, I thought what they were trying to do is, it looked to me like they were setting it up that Logan had did it, and that we weren't supposed to believe he did, and I thought it was going to come out that maybe he did, but I thought it was too dark for the show. And I didn't think it would end with him. So I actually was totally in the dark, and it made perfect sense to me.
Well, it was one of those things where the mystery that they don't give you all of the pieces in order for you to be able to put it together yourself, which I'm fine with because I don't like to know before it comes together. But the nice thing is it didn't make you feel like you were stupid for not figuring it out. You know, some mystery stories, it just kind of are like in your face with their answers. And this was not that. It was just, I think, carefully veiled until the moment they chose to reveal it, and I liked that.
Right. Yeah, they did a really good job of setting up his character as being capable of that without being so aggressive that you were like, oh, he obviously did it.
Well, he almost beats the guy to death, though.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That episode, a few
later, you're like, okay.
Right. I mean, but when you see that like a second time, you're like, yeah, clearly it's because he's psychotic, and Veronica even mentions that. But, you know, in context of the episode, it's very over the top and obviously inappropriate, but at the same time, it's set up in a way that it's like, oh, I get why he did that. Like, you know, because it's this abuser that's been beating on his daughter, so he's getting revenge. And it's like, it's over the top, but it's not like this out of nowhere. It's not like he's violent out of nowhere. He's violent in response to a situation and inappropriately so. And he's, fanatic about protecting the family.
Mm-hmm. And it's also set up, I thought, that they were trying to establish his violence to create, like, a reason for Logan to be as troubled as he is.
Yeah.
So the first time I saw it, I actually read that as, you know, sort of backstopping the idea that Logan might have been the one that did it because he's so abused by this terrible father.
Right.
Also, during the time when Aaron was like beating the boyfriend of his daughter, he casually mentions that like his father abused him and his mother. So there was like a whole history behind it. So that kind of like came into play, which was funny because he thought it was okay for him to beat this guy up. But, and I guess he didn't see him beating his son up as bad, but it's like that pattern thing.
Yeah, I don't think he saw himself like, I mean, I think of the depiction of abuse was good as I don't think he saw himself as abusing his son. I mean, think in the context of the show, they present it that way. Like the, remember that time you went to SeaWorld and your mother was dressed as a mermaid, which is a cruel mm-hmm. story anyway, because they yeah. made fun of the mom. And then he's like, yeah, I remember when you bloodied my nose and what was it? Did something knock the drink out
milkshake,
of my
milkshake? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Took my milkshake away. And he's like, no, you spilled it. And I was reaching back. It's like, yeah, it's what abusers always say.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it like the second or third episode that he does, like it clearly suggests, I mean, he's whipping Logan with a belt for. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not long after he's introduced as a yeah. character that he's going insane.
And Logan has to choose the belt, which is the ickiest right. part of that whole yes. scene. Ugh.
There was some music that was playing that was like really like creepy.
Oh, there was.
I don't remember which song.
I can't remember
what
song it was, but it was. That's another thing about the show in general, that they use music very well. Not in mm-hmm. the first couple episodes because I just rewatched those, but yeah. As the show goes on, music is used very well to set a scene or to evoke a particular emotion or to underscore somebody's character trait.
Yeah. Those early episodes are good, but it was interesting rewatching that it didn't really start firing on all cylinders for probably 6 or 7 episodes. I mean,
yeah.
always good, but then it, like once it gets what it's doing and really figures it out, it's like almost all the episodes are amazing.
For yeah. me, it's once Troy leaves is when the show turns a corner, because I think dealing with Troy, that like the pretty boy almost boyfriend, that they have a hard time figuring out where he fits and how Veronica's supposed to interact with him. And once he's removed from the situation, they can just play with the core characters and let everybody follow their particular interests and the pieces of the plot that they're most interested in. I think almost he was too much extra. And once he leaves, that's when you see Dick and Cassidy come in as the, you know, the sidekick goofballs. Yeah. And that's a much better compliment to Logan.
Yeah, I always thought that relationship with Troy being like, it felt really fast, considering mm-hmm. like how guarded she was against like the O-Niners and like that whole group, and then she like fell into with the new boy really fast because he was nice to her. And I always thought that was like kind of strange, but then his character was gone pretty fast.
I was glad. I was really, I loved his comeuppance. That was so sweet and perfect. and he deserved it. Hey, I want to cycle back to the episode one, because it's yes. interesting. So I've only watched once through. I'm sure at some point now I'll watch it again after I watch the whole series in the movie. I turned on episode one. I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, oh no, I started too far in the series. This is an episode one. And a couple times I actually checked, because it's Amazon. You never know.
Yeah.
Maybe they labeled it wrong. And I'm like, and I get to the end of the episode. I'm like, nope, that was really number one. And holy cow. And I think I knew that there was discussion of her being raped in that first episode. I knew it led off with it, or was very mm-hmm. early. And I'm like, how did they make – no, so I understand like when repeated viewings, you're seeing how the show didn't really get totally into gear in terms of plot and gelling. But in that first episode, I'm like, I felt like I was watching a show that had been on the air for a couple of years and that I tuned in at episode 4 or 5 in a season. And that was pretty impressive to me.
Yeah, I should say that the pilot is amazing. So it's not that the first episode itself is not as solid. That clearly knows what it's doing.
But then like lots of clicks
for the next
in the gear,
few, it's yeah. kind of a – yeah.
Yeah, they throw a lot in there, definitely. Like, they just throw a lot in your face all at once to, like, give a backstory and, like...
The seedy motel, we meet Weevil, the past yeah. relationships, the rape, the her father's disgrace. It's like, I mean, it's a... But it goes, and I immediately understood. I'm like, oh, she has every right to be this bitter, unhappy. Injustices were done to her, and ostensibly I'm going to believe to her father because I know he's not being set up to be an anti-hero. He's the hero who hasn't been listened to, but yeah.
Well, and honestly, if you moved into town and you started going to school at the beginning of that year and you're dumped into the middle of the social scene, that's exactly the experience that you would have, right? Mm-hmm. People have been having their lives and they've had these past relationships, and you have to try to figure out who went with whom, when. And it's overwhelming and it can be confusing, but that's what high school is like. That's another thing that I like about the show is that I remember in high school feeling like every week was packed full of a new adventure or drama or a thing. And it feels like you stuff so much time and experience into a relatively short period of day-to-day time when you're when I was in high school anyway. And that's, I like that the show kind of mirrors that in how much story it packs in to each particular episode and how willing it is to introduce ideas to the audience and not dumb it down, not walk you through it step by step, but say, here's this girl, these are her experiences, mm-hmm. here are her friends, you're going to have to catch up. Let's go.
Yeah, yeah, I think one of the big strengths of this show is that, yeah, it is a great detective show and it works that way and you've got these arc mysteries, but it also really does work as a high school show. You have all of these characters who are sort of milling around in the background and, you know, you see a lot of them early on and they're just, you know, on screen very briefly, have one or two lines, character established, and then they don't come back for many, many episodes and yet they're still there. Sometimes you see them in the background. It feels like a real place. It's not like they suddenly add somebody who is you know, a major player out of nowhere, except maybe Mac is probably the only one who just sort of appears and becomes something. I mean, even Madison Sinclair has her own sort of like little story arc throughout the series as yeah. we learn that her parents are not who right. she thinks they are.
I love when people find out things about other people that they never know about themselves. And then, you know, and does it disclose? That's a fascinating thing in any kind of media, literature, or whatever. And it's like, that's a great little backstory. And you watch her with her brunette family.
Well, the right. crazy thing is, like, later in the episodes, I almost got confused because she wasn't blonde anymore. Like, on the last couple yeah. episodes, she had brown right. hair. And I'm like, wait, is this Jump? And then I realized, like, it's the same person. But I mean, I knew it was the same person, but it just like it took a while to click for a second.
Did they do that for the flashbacks? Because she was in all those flashbacks. Did they make her brunette? Or
I think she was still blonde in the flashbacks.
Yeah,
she
but
was
I wonder
still
if
blonde
they
in the flashbacks.
Did it so and we then, could distinguish the flashbacks better. I don't know. That's funny. It's an odd choice.
It was interesting to me on rewatching, just having, because I had not seen it since the, you know, since 2005 or whenever it stopped. But going back and watching season one, how not present Mac is, because like mm-hmm. when I think later on when you think of Veronica Mars, it's like Wallace and Mac are her two best friends, and those are like yeah, those are the ones yeah. you remember. And
then like that. That's gonna be great.
And she's in it clearly. I mean, like, especially for one of, you know, she's in it way more than Leighton Meester, for example. But you know, it's she's not a major player the way that she becomes later in the series.
Can I talk about Wallace for a minute?
Yeah.
Since I haven't seen I haven't seen the next two seasons yet, right? Obviously. Mm-hmm. Wallace is a disappointment to me. I gotta say, I feel like they built him up. He had some great stuff in early episodes. Then he sort of disappears in importance. And when he's brought back in and has more screen time later in the first season, I feel like he's kind of a plot device as opposed to having that chummy camaraderie that was really present. And kind of when she was sort of, I mean, this is also really high school too, though, isn't it? It's like mm-hmm. you're yep, even
exactly
isolated. yeah. So maybe it's just accurate, but I felt like he disappeared a bit. I sounds like he's, you know, is he there all three seasons, right? He's her best
yeah.
friend.
Yeah. And the movie.
He kind of like finds his own way. Like
yeah,
she starts
true.
Getting busy and then he starts like, all of a sudden he's joined the basketball team. He has this whole group of other friends. He's
right.
like, he was a new kid. So he's like starting to meet other people. He's not so isolated with her and like, he's a really social person, so you kind of see that, I guess, like, even though he, like, breaks away. But I do have to say, as a spoiler, he does have, like, there's, like, a subplot in, like, season two or maybe in season three, I can't remember which, where, like, you get more of his backstory, too.
Oh, good.
I did like, because I noticed the same thing, and it's interesting, I like that Wallace has no fundamental issue with the popular kids the way that Veronica does. Mm-hmm. I mean, like later in the season when he's on the basketball team and stuff, it's not that he's a super popular kid himself, but he's definitely much more comfortable hanging with that crowd than Veronica is, and justifiably so. But the other, I thought, really great thing, and I think they could have done a little bit more with it, because it's like they deal with it textually, but they don't really, doesn't feel as emotionally complete, is in that, I think it's in the second to last episode where, you know, Wallace basically points out that she's been using him for connections and stuff like that. And she finally goes and like goes, look, here's, you know, like she realizes at some
yeah.
point, this is that maturity thing where, you know, like she's really smart and she really knows what she wants to do, but she's not really mature enough to see that Wallace justifiably resents to some degree, you know, the way that she uses him. And then she goes and is like, here's my computer full of evidence stuff and all that, you know, I trust you enough to show that. And then that's like the one thing I think that doesn't really get followed up on very much in that final episode.
Which is that she shows him everything or?
Yeah. I mean, like there's just not really an emotional follow-up with that in a way. There's almost more of an emotional follow-up with Wallace's mom. Mm-hmm.
You know, love that actress. At the very end. She was great.
She was great.
I think she was better than the part was written, I want to say. I think she brought more to it.
Yeah.
I also, before we leave, also, I do love the episode where it's the basketball episode where he's, you know, loving the free cookies that he gets in his locker. And then later on, it turns out that she's the one making them. And it's so sweet because he's like, I thought you thought this stuff was stupid. She's like, yeah, but you don't. And it was such a great, such a perfect line of you're my friend and the stuff that I think is dumb is important to you. And therefore it's important to me.
Yeah.
One of the things that I love about the Wallace-Veronica relationship is that it is a friendship. Like they don't screw around with some weird romance. They're supposed to be attraction.
Yeah.
No, it's a girl and a guy who are friends, just friends, which is totally normal, but not something that you get to see very often on television, particularly when you're talking about young people. Because, you know, they're supposed to be full of hormones and only thinking about sex. But I agree. I really like the fact that he got to challenge her on how their friendship was working and what role she was playing in it.
I also really like that he, like, it was another one of her blind spots that she doesn't really get why Wallace is mad that she's wanting her mom to come back and therefore frees out Wallace's mom in this relationship. And it's like, you know, obviously, justifiably, she wants her mom back. But at the same time, it's like she's very blithe about how that would impact Wallace's family and, you know, their feelings.
Yeah, all those things, I think, are part of what make up the emotional core of the story for me, their friendship. And yes, the fact that Wallace kind of does disappear and comes back as not quite one of the popular kids, but, you know, one of the jocks. And that is sort of the way that you just navigate your way through high school. I mean, most people don't stay besties with the same people from the beginning of high school to the end, you know, much less from 1 year to the next. And I like the fact that they have to negotiate all of these different changes and they still make it work. That's the hallmark of a really strong friendship. And, you know, we've already mentioned that he comes back and they stay friends. So this is, I think we're seeing the foundation built here. Even though he sort of drifts away and they clearly like different things, they cement themselves as excellent friends by the end of this school year.
I think this is actually a great part, you know, and like I say, I'll see more seasons, but this season, everybody grew pretty much. All the main characters and even some of the subsidiary characters. I mean, many of the subsidiary characters had enough of an arc, too. And when watching episode one, I was like, okay, so Duncan's going to be the brooding ex-boyfriend, and that's his role this year. And Logan's going to be the goofy, slightly violent or creepy guy. And then Weevil's going to be the biker. Yeah, I love that guy.
Weevil's great.
Biker with the heart of gold. So he's not that big, whatever. And then it's like, no, everybody, even Veronica. Veronica has to evaluate. She's continually reevaluating her own life. And everything about her life turns out to be sort of, you know, invented, and some things she thinks are true or not. But Wallace, you know, he grows. I think his journey is less because he's not in that bad of shape at the beginning of the year, but especially, and you know, Duncan is boring, but Duncan has to mature, and he does to some extent. He accepts something.
He grows a beard.
Yeah, it grows a beard.
Visits Cuba. Awful beard, yes.
Yeah. And Keith Mars does too. Keith has to go through all these journeys as well. Let's talk about Keith.
Let's talk about
Keith. He is great.
He's so great.
Yeah, because it's so, God, it is. What other father is portrayed on any show, anything like that, where it's so much they're at odds with each other, they lie to each other, they come back together, they love each other so much, and they only have each other. It's incredible.
That moment in that last episode when they have the conversation, he reveals that, you know, I really am your biological father, is so, like, I was teary the second time through again watching it, because it's like, it's so, like, their affection is so overflowing. And you can tell even that it didn't really matter in some ways, like, their relationship is their relationship, but just that, you know, they're affirming their bonds. And then, you know.
But he pulled something on her. He asked her first whether she'd sign it. And it was such a perfect.
And she doesn't even hesitate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that she actually, you know, she has the results in her hand much earlier in the season and decides to shred them because she just doesn't care.
In the middle of the night,
in his bedroom.
That was the best thing.
And I was also weepy at the end when, you know, when he reveals it. And then I love how perfectly, you know, you get that moment of weepy angst. Oh my God, this is so great. And then he says, "Who's your daddy?" And she just laughs, which is a callback to, I think it was the pilot is the first time he said that.
Yeah, he says that a few times.
Just, oh, that's just so well done.
It was also, that was a great, I mean, that was great because you have that extra relief of, oh, thank God there's no incest. We're good now.
The other great, I mean, there's a lot of great moments between them, but I also love that episode where she's trying to break into his safe and talks through all of the birth date and all that other stuff. And she is not quite smart enough to figure out that he knows that she can get in there and gets the thing exploding in her face.
That was wonderful.
Which is just such a great moment between the two of them.
And then he's completely unsympathetic. He knows what she's done.
Of course.
And that's
awesome.
But it's awesome. He's not angry at her. He's just, you know, he knew, he expected it of her. That's why he planted the charge.
She's the perfect amount of pouty about it because she's not the kind of stroppy teenager who's going to have a fit. But you can tell she's enough of a teenager that this has put her out.
And there's so many times where he knows that she's lying and he's sort of like waiting for her to like tell the truth. And she also knows that he knows that she's lying, but she's like being really guarded on like what exactly she says. And it's sort of like this like back and forth, like who's going to give in kind of thing. On like a lot of the Lily Kane stuff, like about the investigation, how much, who knows what. And like,
I really thought Abel Koontz was going to have a different role in the show. Like they're setting him up first, like a Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
Then he's sort of a patsy, and then he sort of disappears. And then the whole thing with Weedman buying off the granddaughter was just, you know, that I thought that was a weird plot hole because it was very important. And maybe, I mean, you have to put red herrings in. Like, that's the way that you get, you know, we're all going down this one path, and they take us down that path, and then it's like, dead end. You're like, oh, you got me, you know? So I realize it's part of it. But wasn't he set up to be? It seemed like he was said to be more important in the scheme of things and then was irrelevant.
Yeah, I almost wondered if the actor suddenly wasn't as available as they needed him to be or something, because they really do set him up like this is going to be an important interaction. There's that episode where she goes to visit him in prison and they have a conversation, and it's so powerful emotionally for her. Yeah. Yeah. Because of what he, you know, what he says to her and how they interact, that you're just like, oh my God, I want to see. I feel bad about it, but I want to see more of this because it's good writing and it's good acting and it's really moving the story forward. And then that character is just kind of gone and replaced, I think, almost with the daughter character.
Oh, I always wondered, like, if he knew Jake and Maranga's mom, like, during high school, for him to, like, know all this, like, backstory. Like, maybe he has his own backstory of, like, he was in school with them and, like, he was just, like, a scapegoat, like, from then on. And I don't know. I feel like he was connected more somehow, but they just didn't explain it.
He was the Peter Pettigrew of this love triangle situation.
It does make sense in retrospect that he's not as formidable presence, just because when you like replay the role, like how the whole scenario played out, he was basically just a patsy that literally Clarence Weedman clearly like found somebody who was willing to take money to claim to have done it because he had some external and like, because he's not, I mean, really, he's not involved in the murder case at all. He was brought in, you know, to fill this, like they needed a villain and the conspirators knew it. And so he was the guy that got tapped.
What do we think about Deputy Doofus, who becomes the sheriff? And I thought, I thought he was being set up for something bigger and he petered out as the season went on, which is fine. Cause I thought the performance was too broad.
He's a bigger presence later. Cause he's another one that I kind of like Mac. I was like, I thought Sheriff Lamb was a bigger deal. And then he's just more present in later seasons.
Yeah.
I found him every bit as annoying, I think, as I was supposed to.
Yeah.
So it worked, I guess.
Yeah. I like that he is really not explained. I mean, he is basically just, he's an opportunist. I mean, he ended up being sheriff because the, you know, the O-Niners, the rich people, kick out Keith. And, you know, they set him up as, you know, he was Keith's protege for a little bit. But then he's also clearly, like, he's a dick, and he's a dick because, and they don't explain it. I mean, like, you know, he's
because he's got, a dick.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's who he is. Like, there is no, like, why was he so awful to Veronica when she reported her rape? Is it, like, because of XYZ? And it's like, no, it's because he was a jerk. And he doesn't like her dad, probably, but...
I am a little sad that they dropped the catchphrase, you need to take a trip to see the wizard.
Yeah.
Which is in the pilot, which is just a stupid catchphrase to have, but I liked how it fit the character and his belief in himself, his overconfidence.
Yes.
That he was doing the right thing and he was going to be fine.
He is the Peter principle in action, promoted to exactly the point where he's incompetent.
Yeah. Veronica's, I mean, you know, this is one thing we should address. We talked about it with Wallace. She is a total user. She really is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I was just finishing up Sherlock season 3 because I hadn't watched the last episode of that. And without spoiling that, for people who haven't seen that yet, everyone should have watched that. I'm the last person to watch this. But there's just like watching Sherlock be that iteration of the character, be an incredible user. I was like, you know, Veronica kind of, she sort of, you know, she feels bad about it sometimes, or she makes it up, or, you know, a lot of quid pro quo. But especially with Leo, like, I mean, she blatantly uses him, and then she's like, you know, but I actually really did like you. And it's like, yeah, but you also really.
And then she asked him for a favor.
Right? That was great.
But you got to appreciate the fact that she first dumps him and then asks for the favor.
Right? Yeah.
She's a very ethical user in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, but Lily was the one of the things I like about the flashbacks is it establishes that Lily was the user before Veronica was the user.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if Veronica has learned this behavior anywhere, it's really obvious. And then once you meet her mother, you see her mother is a very good user too.
Oh, wow.
So as much as Veronica has really great qualities, or the character has really great qualities of her dad, you get to see the influence of that. It's just In Veronica, we get a little bit more maturity and awareness over time that it's being done. And it might be, you know, it might be because of her interactions with her mom throughout the season that she is able to finally realize how she is using the people that she cares about.
I think the fact that she is working for her dad, who has gone from being sheriff to now being a private eye, also factors into that, because this is the kind of business where what she does to help him out is invading other people's privacy, taking pictures, you know, things that are ethically and morally sort of questionable. She really gets to the point, especially toward the end of the series that or season, that she thinks the ends always justify the means. I mean, she steals somebody's personal medical file. It's not even for a case. It's just for her own personal edification. Yeah. I mean, she wants to find out what's going on with Duncan, so she just takes the information.
And she has Wallace steal so many student files that are clearly none of her business. Yeah.
He's just walking around
I love
with
that. Handing to her in the middle of the hallway at school. You're just kind of like, really?
Wide, reading them in public.
That's the thing I like Meg said to her, which was like, maybe you got to rethink this, like, getting even or something like that. Like, you know, I understand the, you know, making things right, but like, maybe you do have friends. And then that actually does change. Like, you see, I mean, the tide turns too. So people are like, all right, we can't totally abuse this girl because she actually, her father wasn't lying. And like, well, other stuff was going on here. So as a neophyte watcher, can I confirm that I understand what actually happened with Lily's murder?
And that you can try.
Go for it.
So because I realized they showed us all these Rashomon views, right? We see different, like, black and whitish or flashbacky things that are different people, like her imagining or other people's imaginings of what went down. So if I understand it, Aaron Eccles, Lily was sleeping with Aaron Eccles. He had the camera in the fan and was recording it. She took the tapes. He came and found her at her house. No one else was there. He hits her with the ashtray or whatever the hell that is and throws in the pool. And apparently no one ever finds – the police are great. They never found that. Apparently, I don't know. I never saw that used – mentioned as evidence anywhere. He throws it in the pool. Then Duncan comes home, finds her, has the epileptic fit ostensibly. His parents come home, or his father – mother first or father, and think he's killed her in a fit. They call Weedman. Weedman comes with – there's that scene – that's supposed to be like a flashback, but it's assumed, like, with he brings ice to, like, chill the body to confuse the time of death. And then, so that's the whole thing, right?
Oh yeah. And then there's the, his Duncan's, when Keith Mars comes in, he notices that they are washing Duncan's uniform, and that gives him like the first kind of like, this is odd.
I didn't get that Duncan had an epileptic fit, but that his parents assumed he did.
Yeah, he was in shock.
Well, remember, he says he can't remember like the next, like he doesn't remember finding her or the next day or whatever when Veronica finds him in the front hallway when she goes and sees Lily's body. He's basically catatonic. Yeah.
Yeah. I just assumed that was shock. Of finding your sister with her head bashed in.
Based on the way the actor was sort of rocking back and forth and muttering and humming, I assumed they were going for a specific fit of some sort.
Yeah, because they sort of make that point later. Like, remember, like, she's reading off, oh, this specific form of epilepsy includes memory, you know, absence of memory, sudden anger, the bit where he, like, beats his car in and kind of freaks
out. Yeah. And it is several days that he's missing. It's not just a couple hours.
Yeah.
Meg doesn't seem too upset that he beat his car in. Like, she's still with him after that, after he, like, smashes his...
Is she?
Yeah, like wasn't that episode
for a little while?
Yeah, but I'm sorry. Maybe this changes in season two. In episode 20, I think in the last episode, they're still together. Maybe in the first of the next season.
Do they have an opportunity to have a conversation after he beats his car in, or does he then immediately for South America?
Wait, does he leave for South America then? Is that when he goes off to Cuba?
No, because isn't that the second to last episode or the third to last episode?
Yeah, I think he's back from Cuba.
It's when he comes back.
So he's
because I was thinking that was Meg's last scene for the season, but I could be wrong.
I
think you're right. It was the last season scene.
Maybe she is gone. I'm thinking. I thought I'd seen her in the last episode because I thought
I remember in season two what goes on in season two, which you haven't seen yet, and they keep not gone.
Yeah. Because she and Veronica talks to her in the second to last episode, which is where she figures out the whole rape like the Shelley Pomeroy's party. Because Meg is the one that tells her that Madison spits in your drink and calls it a trip to the dentist.
That was also fascinating. I was like,
I went the entire trip to the dentist.
You know, I shotgun the season, and I'm going the entire season going like, you know, F. At some point they're going to, this is a family show, some point they're going to fire off the spoiler horn, explain what happened there. And I figure they do it in the season. And then you're like, oh my God, they unraveled it. And then you're like, oh, it's incest. It's like, oh, it's not even that. So it's cool. It was consensual. They're both drugged up. They both didn't have the ability to consent, but they both equally didn't consent to each other. So
exactly.
That's okay. It's not great, but it's okay.
It's messed up, but it's, you know,
Sorry. I was sorry for my confusion. He comes back from Cuba or whatever country he's supposed to be in.
It's Cuba, which is hilarious.
Goes to Logan's surprise birthday party that's not on his birthday.
Right.
And finds out Logan and Veronica are hooking up and then destroys his car.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
My apologies.
That was a great moment when I thought Harry Hamlin was really good in that part.
He is so good in this.
Really good.
Really good.
There's so many great performances because the other one I wanted before we overlook her, because she definitely does not come back really in later seasons, is, I have to say, Amanda Seyfried made Lily, who is a character who could have been extremely off-putting. Like, because she's, like, she is not a nice person, really. I mean, you can see why. But she is you can see the charm, I guess. I don't know. You see why she and Veronica are friends, and you see, like, that kind of, I don't know, the free-spiritedness that, like, if she'd survive, she may have, you know, tamed a bit.
She's the bad boy of girlfriends. Yes, you know,
exactly. Like
she's that friend that you had because they did things that you wanted to do. Yeah, exactly. Right. What you wanted to do, and they encouraged you. And when somebody once described to me, like being the partner or the best friend of somebody who is self-centered makes you feel like you're in a spotlight, because when they shine their light on you, it's like, oh my God, they took the light off of themselves for a while.
Yeah.
So you feel so special. And I think that's what Lily reminded me of. Somebody who, when she shines her light on you, you just feel amazing. Because you know.
That's why she had like a trail of boys around her.
Yeah. You know how much attention she lavishes on herself. So if she can spare some for you, you must be pretty great.
That friendship is really real. from that direction and from the other direction too, because, you know, the popular girls like that who are so self-centered aren't going to have a great friendship with somebody else who is also so self-centered.
Right.
They need a Veronica to follow them around and be dazzled by them all the time.
Right. Yeah. Does Yolanda come back in the next, in the future seasons?
No.
She's the third in that group with Lily, and they had that one episode, Lord of the Bling, where it seems like she's going to be a
I'm pretty sure she does not come back at all.
Oh, that's interesting. So it was funny because it was like they retconned her into the friendship. You know, you're like.
Although it was, in retrospect, it was like a month or something because Veronica said, but yes. I also thought, the other thing that they did really well with Lily was that they do not slut shame her. Like as a show in particular, like she's obviously inappropriately sexual or, you know, like as in she's sleeping with her boyfriend's dad, but this is not hauled out as like, oh, it's okay that she got killed or, you know, she's not, I mean, even Logan, who is obviously probably the most directly hurt by this behavior, just kind of at one point he says that, you know, I love Lily, she loved boys, and he kind of knows that that's the case. And it's not like there's something wrong with her. It was more just that that's who she was.
It just made me realize this is actually like Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks.
I didn't see that to this moment.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, very different narrative, but, you know, Veronica, it could be Agent Cooper. We're getting her voiceover, just not being dictated. And without the supernatural stuff that we know. Although I do like that Lily comes back kind of as a ghost a few times. Yes. Not exactly, but kind of. It was just enough. To be entertaining and magical realism and explicable, but I like that they played with that a little bit.
That final dream sequence that she has in the last episode where they're floating in the pool is really sweet. And it's one of those things that brings home how obviously, you know, Veronica, it was a terrible loss. And at the same time, when you think about it, like Veronica would not be who she is now if this had not happened. And that doesn't make it like that, you know, it's a great trade or anything, but you know, she can't go back, basically. You know, she kind of in that dream is like, you know, this is how it should be forever. And you get, that's not who she is anymore.
How do folks feel about, you know, there's a lot of mythology. This is like the X-Files and other shows. There's the mythology episodes and there's the case of the week episodes, and some are heavier on the other. Well, actually, let's want to talk about one thing is we mentioned Weevil in passing. I love that actor. And I think the part is slightly problematic because he's like the nicest biker. Like the least violent, nicest biker gang guy. Like they use duct tape to put you to a flagpole instead of like stabbing you to death. But I thought the actor was he just pulled off some kind of weird role that he was perfect in it.
His face was like sweet enough that you could like feel like kind of soft hearted for him, but then he'd like bring up the toughness a bit. But then after he played the sweetness a bit, you just like couldn't really believe the tough act anymore. And then, like, he started watching out for Veronica instead of harassing Veronica. And he would just, like, show up randomly with his biker gang to, like, harass some random person. And I don't know. Some of it was sort of, like, he wasn't really that tough anymore. But then the very first, like, pilot, he's, like, her nemesis almost, like.
I'll say the episode with Paris Hilton in which the biker gang appears. She was not bad. That looks just like Paris Hilton.
She did a serviceable job.
Yeah, for the part. She's supposed to be totally super. She should just be exactly herself, right? And she her public image, and she did a great job at it.
They gave her the right lines and the right things to do in just the right amount of time.
That was pretty funny. I was going to cite the episode in terms of the non-mythology episodes. Since I've got the list in front of you, can all bring up what if you want, but the one in which she's defending the teacher. So the plot is Mars versus Mars. Gossip Queen. Mars, you know, accuses, right. And she's working against her father. So this is for folks who don't remember this episode 14, this gossip queen accuses a teacher of an affair. Veronica sets out to prove innocence. His father's been hired to prove his guilt. And, then the reversal is awesome when she's like something, you know, she sort of picks it apart. I also love how they have personnel meetings as the school board conducts them in front of just everybody who wants to be there.
Sure.
That's
yeah,
good. That's just how that works.
And how would you do
I also,
it?
Actually, I loved because I'd forgotten there were so many great guest stars, but I was like, Adam Scott.
Totally.
As soon as he showed up, I would totally forgot that was him. And it was like such a great role for him.
Yes.
Her, so good. The
Rob Thomas crew.
Presaging her later appearance in Glee. It's true. Doing a very good iteration of that.
I mean, Aaron Paul in that earlier episode before Breaking Bad.
Like the creepy
actually, earlier before the spoiler horn, this is the episode that I was referring to when I was talking about how I like how fallible she is because she is so certain that she is right. And then by the end of the episode, she has realized, oh, she was so not right. And you know, isn't feeling so great about it by the end.
But they also don't do an "I told you so,"
right?
Thing in that situation, they don't like force her to have to confront her dad and have him say, "See, I'm the older adult, and I knew how life works." They let her figure it out for herself. That no, this guy's a creep, and there were things that maybe you overlooked that you should have paid better attention to, but hey, it's life.
We actually get a couple of fallible Veronica episodes in a row because then you've got the Rusky business one where she, you know, is all in to help the Russian bride. Part of the mob. Oops.
Well, and there's the episode after that is Betty and Veronica where she makes the totally understandable but really unfortunate bad judgment call of taking all her college money to invest in her mother's rehab, and it's just tragic how that plays out. And you kind of know that that's what's going to happen, as a viewer, but it's just, it's so horrifying.
Then her mother takes a $50,000 check.
Exactly, and I'm
like,
yes.
I want to understand the bank process there that the check got deposited.
Maybe he already signed it on the back.
Maybe.
But, you know, the next episode then after that is, you know, Cain's and Abel's, where she is, you know, using sort of questionable judgment to tell Amelia DeLongpre that her father is in prison, you know, for a crime he didn't commit, but not mentioning the fact that he is going to die in just a few months.
And then she's not going to get any of the money back if she gets the paperwork.
Yeah, I thought it was fair that that's the thing is Weedman, and you're like, oh my God, you know, he's such a terrible person. And he is, sort of. But you know what's funny? He threatens a lot. He doesn't actually do anything. I assume Clarice Weedman was doing all kinds of bad things. And really, he, you know, they subverted justice. But
right.
Which is bad enough. But he wasn't actually out. You know, he's bugging her, but it was all to keep things under control. I mean, in the end, I kind of thought he'd be a worse guy than he was.
They never really explained the photographs with the bullseye on her.
Wasn't that to get Leanne to leave town?
Yeah, what was her name? The mom,
who had, oh right,
yeah, thank you. Who had Mrs. Cain, yeah,
Celeste.
She was the one that
Celeste.
Thank you. So Jake Cain didn't know anything about that. So as soon as he found that out, then he went and yelled at her. So that was sort of a side project, not related to the fact that they were trying to shield Duncan from guilt, but she was trying to make sure that, you know, Leanne and Veronica didn't try to muscle in on any of the millions of the Cain estate.
Although it's also to their benefit from the murder plot standpoint to have Leanne out of town because she can blow apart the Cain, the alibi for the Cains, as I recall.
That's right.
Because she's in the motel room with Jake at a
time. But then Celeste shows up though too. So
right, that, exactly. But that monkey's with their preferred version of events.
Oh, right. Because then they would have to explain. Yeah. But right. You know, this is such a show of mothers and fathers too, isn't it?
It's all about the intergenerational stuff.
Yeah. Even though it seems like a show about high school kids, there's a lot of stuff about high school. It's like, and you have the bad models. You have, you know, everything from the like, you know, the murderous one who's psychopathic murderous father who's also command $20 million a picture or something. And Keith Mars, who's just, you know, he's an exemplar, but he's not perfect. And I love the bit when he's dating the guidance counselor and he doesn't really tell her and then kind of springs it on Veronica, which is the wrong thing to do.
Surprise!
Yeah.
He's fallible as a father too, which is adorable. Is fine.
But then he does, I mean, I feel bad for her. Seems
that was another character, like just side character who I really, really liked the performance of in the writing.
She was so goofy. She'd drop her coffee and it just, you know, klutzy in a really delightful way.
Charming.
She was trying. She was trying.
She really, really wanted to guide some youths.
Yeah.
With her counseling.
Well, I thought she'd have another story, too. And she turns out to be, nope, just a good person. Just a little goofy.
They did bring her back, though, for the interviews whenever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She was another one from Rob Thomas's earlier show because she was on Cupid that he did in the 90s.
That's right. Oh, my God. She's I love that show so much.
Yeah.
The poker game episode.
That's a great episode.
Yeah. Especially, episode.
I mean, that was intricately constructed. It was very clever. It had lots of moving parts. And I felt like it was internally consistent. And then you get, it's like a, it's not a foreshadowing, is it, that Aaron was stabbed in that episode? Although later it seems to be not that big a deal. He's like, he's stabbed and then he's kind of, you know, holding his stomach. And the next time we see him, then it's done. Like, yeah, he's fine.
Yeah, they don't really show him healing or anything, so it wasn't like a serious...
It's a few episodes, to be fair.
It is true. Well, he shows up, it's he goes to visit Keith, and he kind of goes, oh, winces a little, and he sits down. And
yes.
And then that's the end of it.
Oh, right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the Eccles family Christmas.
That was great. The just like, how many women did you sleep with that? Three. Really?
Also, speaking of bit players, because I want to mention him, Cliff, the lawyer friend of Keith, is such a great character.
So wonderful. That and Vinnie Van Lowe.
Oh,
man. And he's another one. Yes. Because he comes back later. But
From
Ken Marino.
Yes.
Ken Marino.
Yeah, I loved him. That was
great. And he was in Party Down later.
And Cliff reappears in iZombie in a few episodes.
That's right.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, that's right. Oh.
Now, the lawyer remembers of, he's like a John Larroquette kind of character, I thought. Like,
very similar. Yeah.
But with what a wonderful voice he has when he first comes in, I was like, oh, this is a guy. And he also plays against type. You expect him. He's not a sleazy lawyer. He's a lawyer. He does his job. He defends people. He gets paid crappily sometimes to be a public defender. And he does his work. But he's like, all right, I'll do you that favor. Whatever. He doesn't become this whole deal. There's no creepiness and whatever.
He's like a good Saul Goodman.
No, but you've got Vinnie Van Lowe for all of your sleaziness. So you've got it balanced out.
That's great when he's singing and
I feel like they like kept that scene on there for like an extended period of time with him like booty dancing and like
totally. Yeah.
Why did he have a mustache that she pulled off?
Because mustaches.
He was being sneaky and undercover to get pictures of somebody and still had the mustache on.
Forgot to take it off.
That was his way of being a professional PI.
His assistant, his mother. It's the mother, the mother child relationship.
Oh, my family.
Yeah.
My favorite bit player is actually San Diego because they shoot all over San Diego. I went to school at UCSD and the episode with the like weird con money changing thing where she breaks into the kids' dorm room.
That was bizarre, yeah. That episode. Yeah.
So it's a totally bizarre episode, but that was all shot on the campus where I lived for 4 years.
Oh, crazy.
So, and I was an RA in those buildings. So like that room, I kind of know exactly where it is in the building. And I knew where they were when they were walking all over the place. And like, when she's out at the tables waiting to be able to break in or listen. So I really liked that, totally personal, but I really liked that they actually used a lot of San Diego because there were many places that I recognized and it felt comfortable to see. It made it more authentic, even though, you know, Neptune is not a real place. It felt very San Diego, Southern Californian to me. Not LA.
They like to create those fake cities for TV shows about detectives or vampire slaying people. So you need
indeed.
That makes sense though. That was San Diego. Just because they were so close to Tijuana, I always wondered like where they were. I knew it had to be close, but San Diego makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And that episode with the college, actually not the college part, but that was another episode that got me crying at the end because that was the one where Logan compiles the video of Lily and they unveil it at the end. And, you know, I love the fact that, you know, talking about parents and children, that her dad gets it and he's laughing through his tears at the end. Mm-hmm. And then you get to see Celeste, who is not right, pleased with it because it's
horrified.
You know, showing that they are, you know, their daughter was less than perfect, but it brought a tear to my eye just like it did to the crowd.
But I think it's good. This is, hey, I'm so glad that everyone suggested it, because I have now, I'm like, this is awesome. It's so, you know, there is, I think we're living in a golden age of really good high, in like 2016, that is, of really good high quality, you know, television and like series production of things. It's really amazing. There's too much to watch, but I don't mind being reminded that like, oh, there's this great thing. There's three seasons of it in a movie. Mm-hmm. You can go back, you watch the whole thing, and it's like,
and
oh.
And a comic book.
Oh, and two novels.
It's true.
Oh, there's two novels.
Two novels.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was one.
I've read them all.
That's excellent.
I read one. I didn't know there was a second.
But so is, I didn't, actually, I didn't realize there was a comic.
But there's a movie that was kickstarted. I mean, it was, yeah, it was the fans,
the biggest,
that made that
movie
happen.
The biggest at the time, like the most kickstarted thing at the time.
Now I understand,
did,
too.
I did donate $10. So $10 of that movie is mine.
I think,
yeah, it might have been $35.
I should check. I think I supported it.
I got a t-shirt.
I was curious about it. So I think I funded it so I get backer updates. Man, I get a, I mean, have a, an ultraviolet download someplace I can still claim.
I like that you backed it without ever having seen the show, Glenn.
I figured I'd watch it someday.
He's a Kickstarter enthusiast.
I was, yeah, I was writing about too much about too. Kickstarter.
It's an impulse buy.
But I, now I've seen the first season. I'm, you know, assuming that, oh, so here's my question. So without spoilers, two more seasons, do they match this in quality?
I think that season one is the best as a complete seasonal arc that tells like primarily one story with a couple of subplots, and you know, if it, but I do think that as you go along, more of her, the side characters get filled in more. Like there's like Mac is the biggest to me, the most obvious, but even Sheriff Lamb, who was not in the first season, he's another one who was not in the first season as much as I thought I remembered. But there are just, there are other side characters who are really interesting. Plus you get more.
It's Dick Casablancas.
Dick Casablancas was the one that I was like, oh, he's not doing very much.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, funny.
He's not even identified until like by name for like 12 episodes.
He's
or
just
something.
That guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. The surfer dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a much bigger part later.
Like in some ways it becomes a more typical TV show in the second and third seasons, which is not, I mean, and I,
well, the third
I don't
season,
think it's
she also goes
good,
to college.
But, yeah.
So that changes and, like new, there's new characters that are brought in.
And they deliberately switch to like, I think it's three or four arcs in the season that start and end before the next one begins.
It's hard to get something as perfect as what worked out with this, though, too. I mean, it really was, you know, it sounds like it was well-conceived. They did some tacking as they went across the season, but they really pulled it off and had a payoff. That's very hard to do.
Yeah. Season, I mean, season, the later seasons are really good. I mean, there's a reason people were hoping it would come back for season four. But, you know, I do think that it like, season one definitely was.
See, I got stalled in Buffy. I had never watched it originally, and then I started a few years ago. I got through a few seasons, and then I got to season five with the nerd, the three nerds who are doing like magic.
Oh, that's robot. That's six actually, but
oh,
yeah.
Six. Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah, because I got through the Adam season, which was bizarre.
Four. Yeah,
and then so, yeah, so I get to season six, and she's back from spoilers, back from hell or heaven rather, and I just kind of hit the wall. And I do want to watch the rest of it. I'm told season seven isn't that fantastic, but it's like Veronica Mars is a different animal because there's fewer episodes to watch. But also, I have really high expectations. I feel like I've seen the best of Buffy. I've seen the body episode. I've seen that, but Veronica Mars, I have much more to watch.
Yeah. I mean, I would say go into the rest of it without expectations that are terribly high and you'll be fine. You'll still enjoy it. Okay. But if you expect everything to play out as perfectly and intricately well plotted as this, you'll probably be disappointed.
that would be hard.
And the one thing I liked about the movie is they brought in a lot of the small little inside jokes from each little season to kind of like a little nod. So if you were really familiar with the series, you would kind of get that. And then, but if you hadn't watched the series at all, you would still enjoy the movie. So that's one thing I really liked about the movie too.
Great. Yeah, I think fan service is probably its greatest strength, to be honest.
Yes.
I am looking forward to seeing it again after rewatching two and three, because I saw the movie when it came out, but had not watched the show since it ended, basically.
Oh, wow.
And it was same like, here. And it was good, but it was like, there, I know there's a ton of stuff in here that I would appreciate more if I'd watched the show yesterday.
Mm. This actually is interesting to me too, because I binge watched it. I mean, I think it was probably over a couple of weeks and really just a few days. I had some families out of town at some point. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to watch like seven episodes in a row. And I was like, whoa. That's that, not to get too deep into the current situation in the world, but the fact that TV shows are still being made in as a series with distinct episodes, but they're being released all at once. I was like, how does that work? And I'm like, oh, I just basically did that. Now I understand that. Like, I wasn't sure. I mean, I understand the idea of having individual stories and breaking things down and so forth. You know, instead of trying to make a 10-hour movie, you're making a bunch of little things that have their own self-contained arcs. But it really made a lot more sense. And I think Veronica Mars works really well binging because of the story arc. So I'll probably watch the next two seasons on a slower basis, because I don't think I'll get the same hit off watching them so quickly.
I think my final thought is just that I am so pleased that you liked it, Glenn, because the show was on. It was on so many years ago, and I knew that I was still going to enjoy it going back to rewatch it. I was even pleased at how much I still enjoyed it going back to watch it. But I always wonder when somebody goes back and looks at something from a very different time in television, different time in the world, and looking at it with a fresh eye in 2015, 2016, that's, I'm always worried that it's not going to hold up in the way that I want it to. And the fact that you enjoyed it from this distance for the first time just thrills me to the gills.
Oh, that's great.
You're here.
It's yes, and thank you all for encouraging me. I hopefully will encourage more people to watch it too. You know, the thing that was funny is the cell phone thing is interesting.
Yeah.
It's the only part of the show that's dated, and her kind of computer usage is dated. It doesn't take me out of the moment. It feels like I'm watching a period piece done today because it's only 12 years old, but it's very modern in terms of, like, there's nothing obvious about, like, production quality or writing. There's nothing about it that would say this was made 12 years ago, except the technology, which then feels. Did anybody see the Silver Linings? What's it called? Silver Linings Diary? Is that the name of the film?
Silver Linings Playbook.
Sorry,
but yeah. No, I have not seen
it. Well, when my wife and I went to see it, we saw it like a week it opened, and I'm looking at it and I'm like, there is something funny about this film. I was like, oh, the technology in the film is exactly 3 years old. And I thought, oh, it's one of these things they made it, because there's certain very specific things, like the dock for the iPhone, but it's very consistent. And I look stuff up later. I'm like, oh, they must have had this in the can for 3 years. And then they released it, and it wasn't it. They were timing it to an event in a football game that happens as part of the plot. They did an excellent job of researching all of the technology and getting exactly the right year technology for it, which was impressive. So I think you could argue, if you look at it, you could probably tell someone, oh yeah, Veronica Mars, it was made in 2014, but they went and they got all these vintage phones. They wanted to make it seem like it took place in 2004.
I just think that they do a good job as a network show that could get really hand wavy with the technology. They actually do a pretty good job with, like, the ethics and the stuff. I mean, there's still definitely some, and then this works because we say it works sort of tech stuff, but it was, you know, like things like the episode towards the end, the mutually assured destruction episode, seemed, you know, sort of applicable even to today, where it's like, oh, I have this compromising video of you. I mean, the funny thing about that is, like, of course that video would have been shared around 5 seconds after it was taken. today.
Right. But
I also appreciate that they don't rely heavily on the let's zoom in and just clear up the pixelated problem that many detectives.
They did that once with Lily's shoes.
Yeah, that a lot of detective or murder mystery shows tend to depend on, like, I'll just zoom in and figure out what the license plate number is. No big deal.
Someone was telling me recently there's a show in which someone says, let's zoom in and enhance, and somebody else says, no, that doesn't work, really. You know that. It's like, oh, I don't know which one was. Great. What a great guy. All right. Well, I think it's just up to me to say thank you all for introducing me to the show. I feel like it wasn't meant to be a show to teach Glenn about Veronica Mars, but I was the only one who hadn't seen it.
No, Glenn, this was a show to teach you about friendship.
Oh, the true meaning of friendship. Now I know.
Be nicer to Wallace.
Well, I have dossiers on all of you, so you'll be hearing from me.
It's only fair.
Well, thank you for being on this episode. Jenny, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Katie, thank you.
Thank you, sir. This was a lot of fun.
Erica, a pleasure.
As always.
And James, thanks for wrangling cats to make this all happen.
You are welcome, and I look forward to discussing season 2 at some point.
You're here.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of Afoot, a mystery genre podcast that's part of the Royal Incomparable network of shows. And you can find us at afootcast.com or at theincomparable.com. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back again soon with some more thrilling adventures.